This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a cognitive scientist explains a new theory about why we may be having extra weird dreams during the pandemic. Now, at least two Wisconsin school districts canceled classes on Friday as the country reacted to fake viral threats on social media. Many districts issued statements and increased police presence in response to claims of a trend on the social media app TikTok. Police officials across the state found the threats to be non-credible, but it raised questions about student safety and how school districts should handle these types of threats. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you see reports of these this TikTok alleged trend popping up maybe on your own social media? How did your local school district respond? Do you think it responded appropriately? If you work in a school district, how do you try to evaluate threats, whether they're a call to the school or some kind of vague social media meme? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Jillian Peterson is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University and a co-founder of The Violence Project. Jillian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I want to take us to the end of last week. We had this these series of messages people were posting on TikTok, not threats, not even people saying, you know, they had seen threats, but saying, hey, this is a day when lots of people are going to be making these threats. Can you talk about that? What happened in the position that put school administrators in?
Yeah, we've seen across the country, really since about September this year, we've been tracking these threats, and we've seen a consistent rise in the number of threats that schools are getting across the country. And then in the weeks post the Oxford High School shooting, it really skyrocketed, where we were just seeing hundreds of threats per week that schools were having to navigate. Then this happened at the end of last week, where there was a TikTok challenge that declared Friday American School Shooting Day. And this went viral across the country, and schools were in this incredibly difficult position of having to figure out, is it credible? Is it not credible? How do we respond? And I think in the wake of the Oxford shooting, schools wanted to over-respond rather than under-respond.
Can you talk about what kind of things schools can do when they see a threat of whatever sort, as I mentioned, a threatening call or social media post targeting their school, a nationwide vague threat like we saw at the end of last week? What kind of things should be on the checklist of schools to try to figure out if this is credible or not?
Yeah, the most important thing is actually to put some systems in place before sort of a threat hits your school. So things like having reporting mechanisms, anonymous reporting mechanisms, ideally, that kids and parents can use, talking to kids in the school about the importance of reporting things, if they see something, to say something, and that report will be met with kind of care and concern rather than swift criminal charges. We want to increase kids reporting when they're noticing things. The ideal situation is have either a threat assessment team or a crisis intervention team, but a team of people at the school that includes public safety, school administrators, mental health professionals that can evaluate that threat in the context of that student's life or in the context of the school and figure out kind of the right way to move forward.
The worry on that side of things would be if there are so many non-credible threats. It seems like schools are going to be tying up a lot of resources and in staff and things like that, understandably so, in dealing with these things that aren't going to emerge as threats.
Yeah, and that's the sort of nightmare thing about this, is that schools are trying to educate our kids. They're strapped for resources. They have to choose between buying textbooks and buying, you know, surveillance technology. They're being put in this really difficult position of having to figure out, is each threat credible or not? What we do know from our research on mass shooters is that they do leak their plans ahead of time, and they do tend to threaten before they do it. We saw that just play out a few weeks ago. And so every time a threat happens, it has to be taken seriously. But knowing that the vast majority of them are going to be jokes or hoaxes and nothing to actually be worried about.
Talking to Jillian Peterson from the Violence Project and associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University, looking at threats to schools, threats of school shootings, and how schools can respond and try to sort out non-credible from, sadly, credible threats. You could join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is this something that you've experienced in your district, whether you're a student, a parent, a teacher, or staff at a school? Do you have systems in place, if you work in a school, to deal with these kinds of threats? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Pete is with us in Bondwell. Pete, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Pete?
Yep. So in our school district, we received a somewhat vague general email that went out to all of the parents in the district that explained there was some sort of social media message going around that increased the perception of potential danger to the children, but we didn't get any detail, right? So we were able to use that email to initiate a conversation with our child, but it was really difficult to have that conversation without more detail, more facts. It's really hard to make that assessment and have a more productive conversation with our kid about what was happening, what's appropriate, what are the options, how are they feeling, what are they hearing. They did a good job as far as promoting the awareness, but I think in these situations, you know, if you're going to trust the parents to have those conversations, you know, equip them with all the detail that's available so we can, you know, dig into what are you seeing, what are you hearing, how do you want to deal with this.
And Pete, can I ask, how old is your kid?
He is 14.
Okay. And on Friday, if you made the decision for him to go to school, was it a more stressful school day for all concerned than usual? Your line's breaking up, Pete. I'm sorry, but thank you so much for calling in and sharing that story. Jillian, an incident like this, the parent gets that notification, wonders what to tell their kid. There's a lot of stress there. Do you have thoughts on how to handle that? What schools should be telling parents in these situations?
Yeah, schools are in a really difficult position because a lot of times their hands are actually pretty tied about what they can even legally say about a situation, what they're allowed to say about another student. But we do know that the more communication, the more parents know, the better, even if it makes them uncomfortable, even if it's the school kind of not trying to scare everyone, the more information, the better. And I think this also goes back to the importance of having these conversations ahead of time so that the community knows when our school gets a threat, here's the process. It's reported here, it's analyzed by these three people. We figure out if it's credible or not. We follow up with resources. We make an intervention plan so that parents kind of trust that the school has a system for handling this and knows how to handle it. So it doesn't feel like, you know, this is out of the blue and everybody is kind of terrified, because it's really scary. It's really anxiety provoking, not just for parents and kids, for teachers and staff. I've talked to, you know, teachers and principals across the country that are kind of at their wit's end already. And then you add in the threat of a school shooting and it's just overwhelming.
Pete, thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. Sorry, we lost your line there in your second response. Let's go now to Austin in Racine. Austin, hello.
Hey, what's up, everybody?
Not much. How are you doing? What do you want to bring up, Austin?
So one thing that I noticed is earlier when you were talking about ways to, like, build up better environments in schools, just something for, like, everyone to think about is, like, involving police in this is categorically a bad idea, because, you know, we've seen when you involve a lot more police in schools, students of color get disproportionately targeted. And also, cops have done nothing to stop school shootings that they are placed in. And what we need to do instead of bringing quote unquote law and order into this is we need to build better environments for students, you know, and that's what we just need to do, period, in communities.
Austin, thanks a lot for that call. Jillian, first of all, you and your colleagues at the Violence Project have looked at the role of police in school safety. What do we know?
Yeah, we did a study where we actually looked at schools where there was either carried out a school mass shooting or attempted mass shooting. And surprisingly, we found that schools that had school resource officers on the ground actually had more casualties than schools that didn't. The reason we think this is that over 90% of perpetrators of school shootings are students of that school. They are kids who are in crisis. They are actively suicidal. And typically a school shooting is sort of meant to be a suicide in addition to being a homicide. We've talked to perpetrators of school shootings who say the police officer there was actually the reason why I went, hoping that I would be killed in the act. Now, when it comes to threats, a lot of what the caller says is correct. We know that if somebody is in crisis, they're actively suicidal, they're making this threat. Our research shows it really is a cry for help. You don't say that publicly if you're not looking for someone to intervene. It's kind of this last ditch cry for help to see if anyone's listening. So the way we want to intervene is with resources, is with intervention, is really not things like criminal charges, which is just going to exacerbate the grievance with the school, exacerbate the crisis. Now, it's harder when there's an actual weapon involved. When there's an actual gun involved, then oftentimes the police do need to get involved. But if it's just a threat, there's a lot of different strategies that schools can use to figure out how to really holistically intervene to make sure that kid sort of gets off that pathway.
Austin, thanks for the call. We're talking about school threats and safety with Jillian Peterson, Associate Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Hamline University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the role of social media and social media platforms, the way that threats can go viral online? What responsibility do they have to regulate online threats? What do you see in your own school district when it comes to how threats are reported, maybe to parents, to students, how these things are handled from your viewpoint as a student, a parent, a school staff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Hamline University Criminal Justice Professor Jillian Peterson about threats and school safety. Jillian's co-founder of The Violence Project. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of what you've seen from your local school district and law enforcement when it comes to evaluating threats, credible, non-credible? Has this issue come up in your school in the last week, in the last few months? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jillian, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, but wanted to share a story. Her son was kicked out, she says, of school for making a threat. She says he needs mental health resources, but the school doesn't have them, and the only tool they seem to have is suspensions. Wondering what can be done to help out those kids. Obviously, traumatic for all the kids involved and for the mom in this case. Jillian, what kind of resources do schools need?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of times what the school has at their disposal is things like suspensions, expulsions, criminal charges. Our research on mass shooters, what we know they have in common is that they often have trauma histories. They are in an active crisis, they're suicidal, they really need mental health intervention. That, you know, excluding a child, pushing them out, it really just makes matters worse. But a lot of schools just don't have those resources in place. So when we think about how do we make our schools safer, what does public safety look like? I think things like mental wellness, you know, school counselors, school social workers, school-based mental health has to be a really important part of that discussion. That's just as much school safety and may, in fact, be more effective than things like, you know, security cameras and metal detectors at the doors.
We had our caller Austin earlier saying he would want to see schools create a better environment. One, I imagine, where kids could come forward to say, hey, I need help, where kids could report potential problems without fear of, as you mentioned earlier, kind of retaliation against the student who's making suspected threats. What kind of culture would you like to see in schools in addition to the research resources you were just talking about?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. So in a lot of the cases we've studied, you know, there were school shooting cases where 50 kids knew it was going to happen and nobody told an adult. And so we really need warm, welcoming environments with really strong and trusting relationships between students and adults in the building. Kids are having such a hard time right now. They're in crisis in so many ways coming out of this pandemic that they really need adults who have the time and energy and space to kind of listen to them, to notice when things are off or when things are different, to have systems in place where they can report students that they're concerned about and that somebody will follow up. So anything we can do to really build those strong, trusting relationships, that's another really important piece of violence prevention.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Brian is on the line in Hollandale. Brian, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Brian?
A couple months ago on Facebook and other social media, I believe it was, they had the Dads in School group in Louisiana. I don't know if you guys remember that or not. It was the school district that had like 30-some fights in a couple of weeks.
Right, Brian, I have seen that, Jillian. I've seen headlines of, as our caller was saying, dads showing up to kind of just be there, be a presence in schools. I think the report on Louisiana saw at least a short-term turnaround on violence. What do you think of the idea of volunteer parents on campus maybe being that extra set of eyes, but maybe that trusted adult who somebody could talk to?
You know, I think schools need all the help they can get, and certainly parents are a really important partner in all of this. So kind of the more adults around that students can go to, that they can have conversations with, the more people around that can de-escalate situations, that can notice kids in crisis, that's all going to be better. We know that, you know, schools really need more resources right now, and if that's volunteers and if that's parents, that's fantastic.
Thanks for the call, Brian, at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the ways that schools deal with threats, individual threats, wider spread social media threats of school violence. Jillian Peterson is with us from Hanlon University, co-founder of the Violence Project. Jillian, one response we've seen in schools around the country is a lot of investment in safety technologies, different kinds of door locks and surveillance systems and things like that. You and your colleagues have looked at that. What do we know about whether those investments are paying off?
Yeah, in the book we published this fall called The Violence Project, we have a whole section where we look at this kind of whole school security industry. And it's a $3 billion industry. It's massive. Again, it goes back to the fact that the most likely perpetrator by far is a student of that school. The student is in the building. They are going in and out of these doors and these systems every day. They know exactly how everything works. They're running through all the active shooter drills. They know where the SRO is located. These are insiders, not outsiders. In some ways, it makes it a lot harder to prevent because all of that technology is based on the fact that it's an outsider coming in. But in some ways, it makes it easier because we can think about what sorts of systems and things do we need in our school to make sure none of these kids are going to want to do this.
We had another caller who couldn't stay on the line. Just wonders how parents should go about talking to their children about these kinds of issues. This could be a whole separate conversation, but when it comes to safety in particular, what do you want to see parents talking to their kids about when it comes to reporting potential threats?
Yeah, I think just opening up those lines of conversation about how they're doing with this. This increases anxiety. This can make kids feel really afraid. And so opening up those conversations, we know just getting kids talking is actually really helpful, but also talking to kids about the importance of when they notice something is off with a friend or when they see something that concerns them, who do they report? How do they report? And why do they report? Also for parents, there's really this sort of critical component of safe storage of firearms. We know that kids who do this almost always use guns they take from their parents. So schools encouraging safe storage campaigns is another thing that parents can do within their own home.
I want to bring things around back to social media platforms that kind of kicked off our conversation with this alleged TikTok trend last week. Are there things that we could learn from this that you'd like to see maybe the social media platforms themselves do differently?
There are, and I think we're just getting started on these conversations with social media companies and what is their responsibility for things that go viral on their own platforms. You know, schools across the country cannot shut down every time there's a threat that goes viral on social media. So I think what role do social media companies play in this and what's their responsibility is a huge question. Kids, we know a really important part of the equation when it comes to school shooters is this kind of social validation, that they look for people on social media that are validating their thinking, that are telling them it's a good idea. They're in chat rooms, they're in the dark corners of the internet. And so if social media companies are providing that validation to kids that this is okay and this is normalizing, you know, that is something we really need a bigger national conversation about.
Just in our last couple minutes or so, what kind of things would you encourage school leaders to be doing right now to start to get the systems in place that you're hoping to see?
Yeah, I think creating just a reporting mechanism. It can be as simple as an email address or a Google form. Getting a team in place, a formal team that can assess these threats that they come in, and making sure that they have their communication systems in place. And so that everybody in the school, the kids, the staff, the parents know how to report concerns and understand how they're going to be evaluated and dealt with.
And we've got, of course, this pandemic. We're just coming in a lot of these schools out of a long time of kids not being in the schools. Has that thrown whole new wrinkles into how we think about threats?
It really has. Because all the risk factors for violence, things like isolation and hopelessness and long times online, have really gone through the roof in the pandemic. And also, teachers are really good at noticing when kids are off, kind of noticing when there's a change in behavior from baseline. But having not been around kids for so long, we really don't know the baseline of these kids. So it's hard to assess when something seems off. So it just makes this whole thing so much harder.
Jillian, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Jillian Peterson is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University, co-founder of The Violence Project, and co-author of a book called The Violence Project. We talked to her and her co-author earlier this year. You can find that conversation in our archives at WPR.org. She joined us today for a look at threats of school violence on social media and how schools can assess the risks when there is a threat, sometimes even a vague threat like that. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, it's this week's edition of Ask a Contractor. This week, a look at the wide world of smart appliances and smart gadgets for around the home. What is worth getting? What's a waste of money? What could even be a security risk? Call in with your own experiences, the gadgets you have around the house, the ones you're maybe wondering about getting for Christmas. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get an update in an ongoing investigation into electrical fires caused by low-quality wiring in some rental properties. Now, a lot of people have been reporting weirder-than-usual dreams during the pandemic. Now, you might counter that dreams are known for being weird, but actually research shows that most of our dreams are pretty boring, mirroring what happens in our day-to-day lives. So these extra weird pandemic dreams are out of the ordinary. A new theory says that the bizarre dreams might actually serve a purpose, helping our brains learn better. Jim Davies is a professor of cognitive science at Carleton University in Canada who studies dreams and wrote a book on imagination. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
So dreaming, is it just random stuff or do we think it serves a purpose?
Oh, God. Nobody knows. You know, it's hard to, everybody dreams and, you know, almost every animal dreams even. And so to say that it has no purpose is probably wrong, mm-hmm. but you know, we don't really know what that purpose is.
Is this a thing? People's dreams have been getting weirder during the pandemic?
Yeah, there have been reports of that. And it's not really clear why. I mean, there is a theory that has an explanation for why, but it's a very new theory. And I just should say at the outset that one of the really cool things about dream research is that nobody agrees on anything. The theory is like, we don't really know how dreams are made, what they're for, why they are the way they are. We have some very interesting theories, but there is no scientific consensus on what's right. And there are going to be some breakthroughs coming, hopefully in the next 30 years or so.
I want to check out that theory. You wrote about it online. Tell us about this idea of why we might have extra dreams when our lives are you know, sort of boring and you know, not that interesting.
Right. So as you mentioned in your introduction there, most dreams are pretty boring. And the reason they don't seem that way is because we don't tend to think about them very much when they're boring. But when you, you know, when you carefully study the content of dreams, and you do that by putting them in a sleep lab and waking them up periodically and say, hey, what were you dreaming? A lot of them are just like, I was waiting in line. I was like trying to organize cards. You know, the reason we think they're weird is because we tend to think about and repeat and tell people about the weird dreams. Right. So I had a dream once that I went to a guy's funeral and all of his toes were in little tiny coffins. Now, I've told that dream to people like 50 times. So, of course, I remember it really well. And I don't remember the boring dream I had of just, you know, running away from some scary guy. But we do have bizarre dreams once in a while, right? And what's curious is that we don't really notice, most of the time, we don't notice that they're bizarre while they're happening, right? So these are just some of the facts about dreams that the theories have to contend with.
What would
anyway,
be
the... so the...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this new theory of dreaming, it says that that we do dream about weird and unusual things to keep us from doing something called overlearning. And overlearning is a concept from the new wave of artificial intelligence called deep learning, which is basically you know when you give a neural network a lot of data, if you let it run too long, it will overlearn, which means that it will basically memorize the training set. And it won't generalize very well when you give it something new, right? It's almost as if you teach somebody to recognize a Macintosh by looking at a bunch of Macintoshes that have a scratch on it. And it comes to think that if it doesn't have that scratch, it's not a Macintosh, right? That's kind of what it's like. So the idea is that similar to the way we deal with this problem in artificial intelligence, that your mind is creating unusual things you have never and probably never will see to keep your mind from getting a little too crystallized and overlearning what you've experienced during the day.
So it gives us practice dealing with different stuff.
Yeah. And practice, the practice theory of dreaming is in several other theories too. That we're practicing for dangerous situations or we're practicing for social situations in a safe environment to do so. But what those dreams kind of rely on dreams being realistic. This new theory actually is the first that has a reason why they're sometimes weird.
I want to ask about how hard it is to study dreams. Because I know when I am waking up from a dream, there's probably a period where I'm full on dreaming and then I'm halfway awake and trying to make sense of the dream. So I don't know, by the time I'm awake and telling you about my dream, it might not resemble that original dream that much at all. How do you sort that out?
It's a huge problem, right? And the reason it's very hard to study, and mostly because it's expensive. You have to have a sleep lab. You have to hire people to stay in the sleep lab all night, like scientists and participants. You got to wake them up constantly and ask them what they're dreaming. And even when you do that, you know, by the time you've said two sentences, you've forgotten a lot of the dream, right? So it's very, very hard to study dreams. There's also just not a whole lot of interest in it. I mean, it's something that people love to talk about. Every time I give a talk on imagination, half the questions are about dreams. But scientists are not super interested in it. There are a few people doing some really great work. It's expensive. It's difficult. It's difficult to measure. And it's like, you could dream about somebody you haven't even thought about in 15 years. So, you know, trying to come up with a theory of dreaming that applies to everybody when we don't even, you know, it seems like sometimes the things you dream are so idiosyncratic to the way you are that, you know, psychology is about coming up with theories that apply to everybody. And it's just been proving very hard to do that.
But a few minutes ago, you said, you're hoping to see some big breakthroughs in the not too distant future. Given what you just said, why are you hopeful?
I'm probably unrealistically optimistic, to be honest with you. But you know, we're increasing the number of scientists, right? And I think dreaming. There are a whole bunch of things in psychology that used to be kind of taboo that are now less taboo. Creativity, consciousness, love, dreaming. A lot of these things are now respectable research areas. And as new people enter the field, they're going to feel welcome to study those things. So I'm really hoping that there'll be more research on it. I mean, given that we spend a third of our time sleeping,
yeah,
it's amazing how little research and how little we understand sleep and dreaming.
Well, now you had Freud, right? He spent a lot of time thinking about dreams in a very particular way. I don't know, why did we fall? Is it his fault? Do we fall out of love with dreams because of Freud? Or why did we stop studying it?
That's an interesting question. I don't really know if that's the case. I know that Freud, for scientific psychology, he made a lot of things taboo because he wasn't really a scientist. Like he was a theoretician and he came up with a lot of very interesting ideas, and he's a great writer. And he captured the public attention and a lot of intellectuals at the time, but scientific psychology sort of left him behind. So, you know, even though he's had a very big influence, particularly on the value of the unconscious, that's an interesting idea I've never really thought of before, that maybe Freud's emphasis on dreams has made it taboo. It could be.
Do you have any advice as you leave us for how we can, I don't know, think about our own dreams? And even if we can't figure out why they're there, maybe use them to inspire our own creativity and imagination?
Well, I think a really exciting thing is if you can have a lucid dream, which is where you sort of are aware in your dream that you are dreaming. And that's very hard to do, but there are things you can practice to try to make it happen. None of them work very well, I'll just say out front. But one of the things that I like is if you see some text, you look away and you look back, does the text say the same thing? So one of the reliable things about dreams is that text tends to change and technology doesn't work super well. So if you look at your watch or whatever, so if you just make a practice during the day, if you see a street sign, you look away, look back. Is it the same street? If it is, you're not dreaming. That might seem a little bit silly, but the idea is you get into a habit of that. And then in your dream, if you do it, you'll suddenly realize you're dreaming, you'll go lucid. And once you do that, you can explore fantasies, you can fly around, you can practice basketball, and then it'll work. Like practicing things in your dreams has proven to improve your performance in real life.
I'm so going to try that, Jim. Thanks for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
Jim Davies is a professor of cognitive science at Carleton University in Canada and author of the book Imagination. He talked to us about what might be causing weird pandemic dreams and the function they might serve. Producers, if you really want to mess with me, keep changing the script on my screen here so every time I look away it's different. Then I'll think I'm dreaming. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a question about the holiday cocktail known as the Tom and Jerry.
Every season has its cocktails. In the summer, it's gin and tonic with a twist of lime, a margarita, or a Long Island iced tea. When the temperature drops and the snow piles up, people want a little more warmth, like a hot buttered rum or spiced mulled wine. During the holiday season, folks in Wisconsin turn to a hot drink known as the Tom and Jerry to warm them up. That got listener Pam Stokowski of Whitewater wondering,
is Tom and Jerry's a Wisconsin thing?
We were intrigued and decided this topic needed some serious research. So we asked someone who has spent some time studying the cocktail.
Down on the corner, the crowd is so merry. I wind up by having about 12 Tom and Jerry.
Well, maybe someone who has a slightly more scholarly approach.
My name is Jim Drager. I wrote a book for the Wisconsin Historical Society called Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries.
We thought Drager might know if the Tom and Jerry is unique to Wisconsin and why that's so.
I think there are a couple of reasons why it's a Wisconsin thing. First of all, it's basically a farm-based drink because it has dairy and eggs in it and butter in it. So, you know, for us Wisconsinites, that hits home to that sweet spot in our heart for dairy. And I think the other reason is because it's a drink that has brandy in it. And as we all know, Wisconsin has a thing for brandy.
So we have a dairy connection and the Scotty favorite, brandy. But did the Tom and Jerry originate here, or does it come from somewhere else?
There is an American mixologist named Jerry Thomas who claimed credit for it in the 1860s. He published a recipe for it in the first cocktail book written in the United States, but historians have demonstrated that was around before Jerry got his hands on it. There's actually a known origin for it. In the 1820s, a London playwright created the drink to popularize a play that he had written that had two characters named Tom and Jerry in them. And it just took off from that point and became popular.
The play was called Tom and Jerry, or Life in London, by William Moncrief. It was quite popular at the time, running for over 2 years in London before coming to America. The Domino Bar in Wausau specializes in making Tom and Jerry's, serving over 4,000 of the hot concoction between Thanksgiving and New Year. Bar owner Dan Bauer is not sure if the Tom and Jerry is a Wisconsin thing or not, but he does say,
I know they're very popular around here, especially when it gets cold. The colder it gets, the better it gets. Warms you up inside.
Bauer says the tradition of making Tom and Jerry's over the holidays started at the Domino sometime in the 80s and gets bigger every year. Bartender Donna Seidler put one together Domino style.
We have the bowl of the Tom and Jerry mix. We do a swoop and spoon of the top secret batter. And then we add a shot of dark rum and brandy. And we have to make sure the water is rapidly boiling. And as we pour that in the cup, give it a couple of stirs. It's nice and frothy on top. Top it off with some of the sprinkles. And that is a Tom and Jerry.
Lovely.
If you can't make it to the Domino during the holiday season, you can make Tom and Jerry's at home. Just don't forget to get a tub of batter from the market.
No, I didn't forget. The tree is up and the Tom and Jerry mix is in the refrigerator.
So gather around the fireplace with your family and friends, light the tree, and enjoy the season.
What do you have, lad?
Oh, whatever you're having, sir.
I'm having Tom and Jerry myself.
Special thanks to Rob Mentzer for his help with this piece. This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up, an investigative reporter shares what she's found about electrical fires in Milwaukee and why they disproportionately happen to low-income Black residents. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. An ongoing investigation by the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel has found that low-income Black residents of Milwaukee are five times more likely to experience life-threatening electrical fires in their homes than anywhere else in the city. Reporters found that in spite of safety violations, property owners in Milwaukee have continued to receive federal rent assistance, putting renters in danger. Daphne Chen is a data and investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel who's been working on this electrical safety story. Daphne, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've talked to one of your colleagues on this investigation in the past. Can you remind us how concentrated this faulty wiring problem is and who is at risk from it?
Absolutely. We started looking at the issue of electrical fires, not even thinking that there was going to be so many racial disparities. But when we started analyzing the data, we found that the highest concentration is in our Black and brown neighborhoods. So as an example, 53206, which is on the north side, had a rate of suspected electrical fires that was five times the average in the rest of the city. And so that's a big disparity that we wanted to dive into.
In a new piece on this, one of your big findings is that Milwaukee properties with electrical violations, reported violations, continue to receive rental assistance. So in effect, tax funding. Can you talk about how that works and why that problem isn't getting fixed despite that?
Absolutely. So, you know, rent assistance, whether it's the regular kind of rent assistance that HUD was giving out, or it's the emergency rent assistance given out during the pandemic, it's supposed to help renters, but it helps landlords too. And actually, those checks go directly to landlords. So for this latest installment, we compared rent assistance data with code violation data. And we found hundreds of thousands of dollars of rent assistance going to property owners that had electrical violations on file with the city that were outstanding at the time. And that's just in the last couple of years. And that's just with a small sample of data we were able to get through public records requests. If you look at, you know, the full amount of data, or if you look at all types of code violations, not just electrical, the numbers are going to be a lot, lot higher.
People might hear that and say, wait a minute, these are electrical violations that have been reported to the city. Action has been ordered in these properties. Why aren't they ending up getting fixed?
Yeah, the inspection program in Milwaukee just doesn't have a lot of follow through. Landlords are given a really long time to come into compliance. Things lapse, especially if a tenant moves out or is evicted. These violations can just kind of flounder. And so in addition to that, there are a lot of state laws that make it hard to enforce code violation rules at a really strong level. So high fines, having pre-inspections before renters move into a home, those things are made really difficult by state law. And so the fact is that in Milwaukee, renter protections are just not very high.
And there's another level here. Sometimes community groups are the ones responsible for distributing, you write, that federal money. You and your colleagues talked to them. What did they say about their ability, their resources to follow up on whether the buildings that are getting this money are risky?
Yeah, so the money usually flows from the federal government to the local level. And then sometimes there are local nonprofits like Community Advocates or SDC that help officials distribute this money. But, you know, a lot of them said, we just don't do checks with this pandemic assistance money. It's just not really in their scope of work. And, you know, everybody is kind of overworked and underfunded in this area. And at the same time, there is another type of rent assistance, which is the HUD, also known as Section 8 rent assistance, that does have more regulations on it. Inspections are supposed to be done by the housing authorities. But in those cases, a lot of those inspections are really limited to what's visible. So an inspector isn't going to move a couch. They're not going to plug in an outlet tester into the outlets to make sure that the wiring is done correctly. It's just not what they do. And so this kind of problem continues to churn along.
Can you talk about some of the hazards renters in Milwaukee have faced because of unsafe wiring?
Absolutely. It's so sad because the reality is that electrical fires are more deadly than other types of fires, but they're also really preventable. And so we're talking about renters who, worst case scenario, have been trapped in fires and passed away. But even if they're lucky enough to escape with their lives, it's just a hugely traumatic event. We've talked to renters who have lost all of their belongings, been displaced, become homeless, you know, looking for emergency housing and kind of just having to take the next thing that they can get, which may also have serious electrical problems. So it's a cycle that continues to really fall hardest on our Black and Brown neighbors. And it can be just really, really traumatizing.
And one interesting, puzzling side note here is, in the communities with a lot of low-income people, there's not a lot of affordable housing. Rents aren't necessarily that much cheaper in these lower-income neighborhoods, so there may not be a place to move out to if you're worried about the wiring in your current rental.
Absolutely. It's kind of a phenomenon that housing experts have known about in Milwaukee and have been researching. The rents really don't vary much across Milwaukee, which seems counterintuitive. But it makes a lot of sense when you look at how segregated Milwaukee is, how much the housing stock is sort of aging, how few renter protections there are. And you see that there are a class of landlords who kind of specialize in people who may not have a high income, may have evictions and credit scores on their records, and can't necessarily just rent from anybody because of these things on their background. And they may have to just accept the best quality of home that they can get. You know, there are a couple studies out there that have shown that not just in Milwaukee, but in other cities, landlords in poorer areas of town actually can make more of a profit than those in wealthier areas.
In just our last half a minute or so, what unanswered questions are you still trying to figure out here with this faulty wiring story?
We're still trying to figure out from city officials and from state officials what they think should be done. You know, a lot of city officials have said their hands are tied by state law. But at the same time, there are housing advocates and experts who say there are solutions that can be explored, such as rent abatement programs or, you know, strengthening inspection programs to better protect renters. So that's the next installment we're looking forward to.
Daphne, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Daphne Chen is a data investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She talks to us about her work looking into electrical safety violations in low-income, primarily Black Milwaukee neighborhoods. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, explore some of the legendary locations from ancient history with the author of the new National Geographic book called Lost Cities, Ancient Tombs. and get a look at the year's best new movies and let us know if you saw them at a theater or you streamed them at home. Reggie, the Real Critic, is back with us with some great recommendations. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.